Good afternoon. Welcome to the Hart Clewitt Museum in historic Troy, New York, for the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal On the Road Show, a production of WAMC On the Road. I'm Ray Graff. Today's episode is being taped, so there'll be no calls, no emails. Instead, we'll be talking with this beautiful live audience as we present antiques, oddities, and ephemera for verbal appraisals from our friends at Stair. The Vox Pop Antique Appraisal On the Road Show starts right after the news. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we're not in the studio. We're not live. Don't call. Don't send emails today. Instead, we're on the road. We are at the gorgeous, history-filled Hart Clewitt Museum in downtown Troy, New York. And this is the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal On the Road Show. We are in... Yeah, go ahead. That's works for me. We are in front of this live audience. They brought their antiques, ephemera, oddities, knickknacks to get verbally appraised by our guests from Stair. We'll also learn about some of the more intriguing items from the Hart Clewitt Museum. So, everybody ready to do this?
Yeah.
All right. My producer thinks it could be a recipe for disaster, but I'm optimistic about this one. We're going to find out together. Let's do it right now. I'll introduce our guests, Catherine Sheehan. Is the executive director of the Hart Clewitt Museum and the Rensselaer County and Troy City historian. A native of Troy, she has lectured on various local history topics. She's been a location and historic background advisor for HBO's production, The Gilded Age. She has appeared on national and international TV and can be often seen giving tours through downtown Troy and Oakwood Cemetery. Give it up for Kathy Sheehan. Colin Stair is a fourth-generation furniture specialist. He worked for Sotheby's in New York and England before opening Stair in 2001. Colin was an early innovator of online auction technology and has successfully balanced the expectations of a modern marketplace with the charm of a traditional auction house. Stair features a team of experts with over 150 years of combined experience. It's one of the leading regional auction houses in America. Lisa Thomas is director of the Fine Arts Department at Stair. She began in the Department of Paintings and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. At Christie's, Lisa was in charge of contemporary prints and multiples and was also responsible for the appraisal and sales of 20th century European, American, and historical American prints. She has been a specialist on Antiques Roadshow. Also with us today, Lauren Anderson, Stair's Director of Decorative Arts. Lauren has 20 years' experience in the auction business and an M.A. in decorative arts from the Cooper Hewitt. Prior to Stair, Lauren worked at Christie's in New York City as a specialist and associate director of museum services. Round of applause for all of these folks. We're going to have some fun today. Before we get started with the appraisals, let's talk to Kathy Sheehan. By the way, Mayor Sheehan's not in the audience, right? So I will call Catherine Sheehan Kathy, okay?
Absolutely.
Works for you?
It works for me.
Kathy, the Hart Clewitt, I've been here for a few hours now walking around, and it is spectacular. Room after room. It's so much fun to be here. It's like going back in time. And frankly, I'm not sure this guy, Peter Hughes, should even be allowed in the building, but whatever. It would take years to talk.
He's behaving so far.
Well, really?
Well, he
okay,
thinks
well, if you say so. It'd take years to talk about everything, but you picked out an item or two that our listeners and live audience might find really interesting. So what did you bring?
Well, Ray, in honor of the last time you were on the road, or I should say your first time you were on the road, when you were with Gail Sokol, and you did the cooking show for Food Friday, I brought this amazing, this is about, I want to be about a foot and a half tall.
Yep.
It weighs a ton. It's heavy leaded. And this is a piece that it looks like Lady Bountiful.
Oh, she is bountiful. I'll be darned. Okay.
And he's going to hold it up and show it to our audience. And it's really, if those of you who ever make Wilton cake pans, You have these. This is a whole piece that you would make ice molds.
Can I touch this?
Sure, go ahead.
If I break it, do I buy it?
No. Yes.
Oh, look at that.
So it's really these became very popular in the late 19th century, and as these very fancy Gilded Age dinners, and they wanted to have these wonderful centerpieces, they would make ices or molds sometimes with like very heavy gelatin, and they'd be all decorated around the platters with japonica flowers and things like that. So we have several in the collection, but the Lucas Confectionery, he was a German baker, came in to Troy in the mid-19th century. So these are from around 1880. And you can see all the little pins. There's pins for each of these pieces. So make the mold, and then, you know, it goes together, it gets frozen and put up, and then pull the mold, it goes onto the table.
What's this made out of, lead?
It's heavy.
That's
lead.
Nutritional.
Yeah, I know.
That's great.
You didn't really eat these things. One of the other pieces, this will be my shameless plug for everybody to come back and see us at our annual Holiday Green Show. He also did something called pastelage, where it was a French process of cutting sugar. And we actually have a sugar castle. And the sugar castle is domed. Many of you have been here for 69 years of our garden green show. It was up the street at what is now a bar called the Confectionery. And so we bring this out every year, and you can actually see these carved pieces. But these were the other things that he did. He was a very fancy baker, as opposed to this wonderful little flat card that we have here.
Oh, look at
and
that.
And you can see what that says.
Yeah.
And this says Fraunhofer's bread. Now, so many people who in the Tri-City area, really the whole area, in upstate New York and into Massachusetts, and I think even a little bit down in New Jersey, Fraunhofer's came up from Pennsylvania around 1913. And what was really interesting about Fraunhofer's is that they were catering to all the working women in the factories. Troy had almost 10,000 women alone working in the collar and cuff industry, like Clute and Peabody, making Arrow shirts. They don't have time to be baking bread. You know, they need an Amy Halloran to come over and, you know, bake bread with us, but they didn't do that. So they started making commercial bakeries. Also in this room, other people here, to see it, we have the bread basket. So in the morning, what you did with this wonderful, I don't know, 4x6, 5x7 card is you put it in your window. And that would signify, as the Fraunhofer route driver was going around, that you needed bread. And usually the regular customers always knew they needed, you know, 3 loaves, 5 loaves.
Yeah.
And this is actually from, you can see it's about from mid-20th century. If you turn the card around, you can see the old exchange, the telephone exchange. And this was from Lansingburg. So it's a Bedford, a BE5 numbers that they had.
Hmm, that's really cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. What else is this?
Yeah, so really quickly, you know, this is the anniversary of the Erie Canal, 1825. And one of the major pieces that went out on the canal, thousands and thousands of pounds, was pottery. And the whole Capital District area, this one is a Troy piece, and no relation to me, by the way. It says M. Sheehan on it, and in Troy, New York. This pottery, this is all clay in this area. So pottery was shipped out west, and so I can't even tell you how many people come in from California saying, oh, I have a Seymour pottery, or I have even Bennington ware just over the border for pottery. These were in Troy, the whole side of the hill, which is now people know as Prospect Park. They had a lot of potters in it. We actually have a pottery district that people have lived in.
You know,
which is cool.
We've talked about this on the show when you've been on, but how do you know something is going to be perfect for the museum? I'm sure you get people offering stuff all the time. Have to say, oh,
even
thanks,
including today.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. So, I mean, how do you make that decision?
Well, sometimes there's there's one person had actually asked about, they had a painting, but it was in really bad shape. Maybe someone could use it as a sample to make something or have students. We don't do that here. We don't do conservation work here. We send things out. So if it was just to come in our collection, it would unfortunately sit and not ever be used because we couldn't exhibit something if it was in that bad of shape. But again, there's a whole criteria of things. I have one more piece.
Okay.
Because Rensselaer County, of course, is largely rural. This is a wonderful little piece. It's something that you might not think about all the time, but when you go to get your eggs, if you go to a farm, this was to weigh the eggs so they knew how to sort them. Are they small eggs, medium eggs?
I'll be darned.
Large eggs. So it weighs it up so you're able to tell you just, you know, how you can price it, because all these farms, these small farms, not even big commercial, small farms had, you know, usually the farmer's wife had a small kitchen garden, and she was the one who was selling eggs and maybe some cheese, you know, small batch things. So this came from a farm out in Postinkill from the Zweig family.
Catherine Sheehan, this place is amazing. The crown molding alone in this room is something to see, and I've been admiring it for some time now. The folks from Stair Gallery are here. Stair, it's just called now. Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas and Lauren Anderson. Colin, tell me about how you founded this business and why.
I had had a really interesting career working at Sotheby's in New York for a long time and running their restoration department and working in different furniture departments and sort of was trained there doing that. And that all changed quite quickly. They had a little crisis and they needed to sort of shed a few people. So I volunteered and I thought, I'd always dreamed of starting my own auction house. And I just it was something I always really wanted to do. And we started in October 2001 in a rented Elks Club. And we moved everything in and set up for 2 days and had an auction and moved it all out. And it was a great, very humble beginning. And we're in a really lovely, wonderful place now.
Lisa Thomas, you focus mainly on art, right? And multiples. What's a multiple again?
Multiple is anything that an artist creates in multiples. So prints are multiples, but you can also have sculptures that are multiples. Sometimes decorative artists create plates, for example, that are done in multiples. So anything where you have more than one.
I want to reiterate, this is a live show. We have a great studio audience here. You guys are great, and thank you for being here. We are WAMC on the road today at the Hart Clewitt Museum. Lauren Anderson, you're a late addition to the program today. You're involved with decorative arts. Tell us about what you do at Stair.
Well, at Stair, I'm the director of decorative arts, and I handle everything that Colin likes to say smaller than a breadbasket. That mainly means porcelain, silver, and Asian works of art. So anything you put on a dining room table and enjoy, or anything that comes out of Asia, is something that I start to handle and appraise.
What's the most exotic, interesting, and valuable thing that you ever saw in line of work?
So in my line of work in totality, the most interesting thing I think I ever discovered is we were in this house in the Midwest, and you know, we were looking around and we had made our list, and then all of a sudden it was like, well, have you looked in the cabinets? Have you been to the basement? Have you been to the attic? Because you never leave a stone unturned once you've turned up. So I was in the kitchen and I looked underneath the kitchen sink, and you know, there's the average cleaning supplies, all things of that nature. And then all of a sudden I saw a tureen handle and I thought, well, that's odd. Why would this be shoved back here? So I unearthed it. It was very beautiful. It looked French at first glance, but wasn't really sure. So came in for sale with a reasonable estimate, and then I started showing it to my other colleagues. Nobody could figure out what it was. So we had a bit of interest before the auction, and then all of a sudden the auction starts, and it's climbing, and it's climbing, and it's climbing, and we're up to $40,000. And my colleagues and I are looking at each other going, what in the world? We have no idea what's going on. Turns out it was a tureen from one of Catherine the Great's services that had long been dispersed and lost, and we found it underneath the kitchen sink in a house in the Midwest.
How did you finally figure out that's what it was?
Well, the person who purchased it told us.
Ah.
You know, it's your audience always knows more than you do on certain subjects.
You're listening to the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Road Show, recording at the Hart Clewitt Museum in Troy, New York. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Road Show. We are at the Hart Clewitt Museum in Troy, New York, in front of a live audience. Yeah. All right, Peter Hughes, our producer, our director here, are we ready to look at some items?
Yes, I think we are. First thing, though, if we could clear the Hart Clewitt stuff here so we have a clear space here for...
Okay. Oh, you broke it. I told you.
Pieces, not a problem.
Hey, kids, try the lead Jello. Delicious. So good. So good. Okay, now let's take a look at some of the items our live audience has brought us. Peter, who's first?
Let's talk to Pamela Benteen.
Ah, Pamela, welcome. Where are you from, Pamela? Ah, well, welcome to the show. Sit down, relax. What did we bring?
I brought my christening cup.
Ah, this is your christening cup.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a little bit special because not only is it a treasured memento, but it was inscribed to be by my godmother, Eleanor Roosevelt.
No way. Can I pass this down?
Oh, yeah. Fabulous thing.
That's beautiful. Okay. It's a nice silver cup. It's a christening cup, maybe 4 ounces. Okay. And let's hand this over to Lauren.
Well, I have to say, I think this is quite a bit more than special. The christening cup tradition goes back to about the 18th century. And basically, they were given as a symbol of prosperity and wealth and wishes for the young child to have a long life. So the fact that you were able to get this from your godmother, the illustrious Roosevelt, is pretty amazing. And in fact, she's also local, which also is something that's near and dear to my heart. But even more special, what you've brought with you as documentation is a lovely picture of Eleanor with you as a young child. What occasion was this taken on? Do you remember?
Oh, we were living in Annandale at the time. My mom's family is from Dutchess County, so that's how we got to know Mrs. Roosevelt in the first place. And so when I was about 5, she came from one of her occasional visits at our house, and this was taken outside as she was getting ready to leave.
And I can just say for those of you who cannot see this beautiful object that it is done in American silver, so perfect for a Roosevelt gift, but also it's done in a very simplistic style that's very elegant. And it shows that, you know, it was something that was considered because a lot of silver was used in this process. As a child, were you ever allowed to play with it?
I think I got to sip a little milk out of it a couple of times, but it was mainly on a shelf for safekeeping.
Well, that's wonderful. And it's beautifully preserved, and it's a lovely object, and it's a family heirloom. A normal christening cup at auction would be around $200 to $400. However, this would be worth much, much more due to its provenance.
Well, I'm not putting it on the market. I'm leaving it on the shelf. But I was just curious what people might think of it. And I don't get to show it off all that often.
Well, I'm delighted you brought it here. And thank you so much for sharing it with
us. Thank you very much. Beautiful. Beautiful. All right, Peter Hughes, who's next?
All right, next on the show, Mr. Graff, is Gene Collinieri. Did I get that right? Gene Collinieri? Come on over, Gene.
Where are you from?
I am originally from Eagle Mills, New York, and now I currently live in Pittstown, New York, which is outside the city of Troy.
Not too far from here. Well, what have you brought?
So what I brought is my stepmother was an O'Keefe. Who it was a big name in Albany, so there was big Irish emigration.
Oh, yeah.
And they ended up in Albany, and this is a daguerreotype in a hand-tooled leather case of her, I believe, and I have her genealogy at home. It's her great-grandmother or great-great-grandmother, and it's probably about what I think is about 1850,
wow.
Perhaps. The Irish famine, they emigrated in the late 1840s to the United States.
What do you know about her? She doesn't look too pleased in the picture.
Yes, I believe that was the style, was to look pretty stern when you were having a picture taken.
Right.
Yes. So this is not her direct descendant. This was this Mr. Taft's first wife. And so, you know, people died young back then, and he remarried. And his second wife was the mother of, who was eventually, her last name became Gibbons. It was Mary Gibbons. She was the mother of Madeline Gibbons, who was my stepmother's mother. So this is why I figure out, when I look at the genealogy when I go home, I'll be able to figure out more approximately when the daguerreotype was done.
Right. It's really wonderful that you're able to identify the sitter and sort of trace it back through your ancestry. And you're right, Ray, they often look scared and uncomfortable. And the reason is that they'd never had their picture taken before. Daguerreotype was the first photography that was ever invented by
a
Frenchman.
That's a silver plate?
Yeah, it's made through a silver-coated plate process. A Frenchman, Louis Daguerre, invented it in 1839. And then some Americans went over, learned from him, and brought the technique back to the United States. But before that, nobody had a way of reproducing your image. A lot of people didn't even have mirrors. So sometimes people were looking at their image for the first time, and it was quite scary.
She would have been scared, for sure.
She looks pretty scared.
Yeah.
What's also really interesting, it's beautifully preserved, by the way. It's in a beautiful hand-tooled case, which is how they were presented. They're super fragile, the actual silver parts. You never want to handle them. They get fingerprints on them, and they break. So that's why the photographer would have a studio that made special cases for them. So the print would be made on the metal and be put directly into one of these cases. But a lot of times the cases fall apart and they're not properly handled. This is really in beautiful shape. So that's great. And the other really interesting thing about it is the Albany connection, because one of the earliest daguerreotype photographers in the United States was here in Albany, the Mead brothers. I think it was Henry and Charles Mead opened a studio in Albany. They're one of the very first in the United States. So 1850 is probably a pretty good circa date for this. I think they were in operation in the late 1840s, and one of them died in 1858. So that's sort of 10, 12-year period. So I think your dating, your circa date is pretty close. So it's really, they're not only are they really interesting because of the history of photography, but also the scientific element. So all of these early photographers were actually trained scientists for the most part, because there were so many chemicals involved in this developing process. So super interesting, really well preserved. It's great that you know who the sitter is. Value at auction, we usually say in the sort of $800 to $1,200 range for one that's so well preserved. But it's really great that you have the provenance and this personal connection.
Oh, well, thank you. And I have two more at home where exactly what you said happened. The leather tool case, the binding came apart, but the photographs are very well preserved in those also.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you. I think a lot of my stepmother when I look at her.
Yeah,
things.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Peter Hughes, who's the next victim?
Next, we're going to be talking to, is it Mark Colcon? Do I have that right? Carlson, sorry. I'm new to reading.
Yeah. Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
All right, Mark, where are you from?
East Greenbush.
Welcome to the show. What have you here?
A painting that has hung in our house for 60 years.
And what do you know about it?
That my dad got it at an auction in Loudonville at an estate sale. Then a couple of days after he got home, he got a call from the attorney for the estate. And the attorney said that it was not supposed to be sold. That he had the papers authenticating who the painter was. And they could not reach a deal, so the attorney kept the papers, and my dad kept the painting.
Okay, I don't want to break this, but I'm going to hold this up for everybody. This would be a real disaster on the radio if
yes,
I broke it.
Yes, you don't want to damage it. It's a really great painting. And tell us who it was attributed to.
Pompeo Batoni.
Who was an 18th century Italian artist, born in Lucca and then painted in Rome. And he was known for portraiture, but also mythological figures. And this is a religious picture. So if it was by that artist, it would make it a very interesting subject for his body of work. It's really well painted. It has some condition issues that we can all see here, some crackalure and some stretcher marks. It's probably had some in-painting done over the years.
What do you mean in-painting?
In-painting is when you see little bits of the canvas flaking off and somebody comes in, a restorer or an amateur, and just dots little bits of paint in to kind of fill it in and help preserve the look of it. Almost all paintings of this age have had some sort of work done to them because it's very difficult unless they're in proper museum storage to survive that many centuries. But one of the really interesting thing, aside from the artist being an interesting artist in his own right, is the story. Because with an artist like this, that you need scholarship and documentation for authentication purposes in order to value it and sell it appropriately. And it's interesting to me that it somehow snuck into this estate sale. And then quickly, I think they realized that they had made a mistake because they obviously had some paperwork to go along with
Correct.
It that would really help you to value it, because this artist at auction when authenticated and supported with documentation, can make anywhere from $50,000 to $250,000 for an authentic painting. Okay. But the flip side of that is that, or the catch-22, I should say, is that you can't sell it as by that artist without the documentation. So I think the estate sort of knew what they were doing. They realized maybe they'd made a mistake and they didn't want this to go out into the marketplace properly authenticated. So the story is fascinating. You could sell it as attributed to, and you could find maybe a scholar of this artist or of that period in Rome to write a letter saying possibly attributed to the artist. And works that are attributed to him in that way do come up at auction, and there's a wide range in value based on subject. And again, I think this is a fairly rare subject for this artist. So value would be anywhere between, you know, it could be $1,500, it could be $20,000, depending on which scholar you were able to find to look at it for you. So it's a really interesting story, sort of the intrigue, et cetera. And it's a very interesting artist. So
thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you for
Be
sharing
careful
the story.
With it when you bring it home.
Very careful.
Yes.
Mark, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Can we talk to Amy Lent, please?
Amy? Okay. I thought you might have left already. Amy, where are you from?
I live in West Sand Lake.
Ah, well, welcome and thank you for being here. What did you bring?
Well, it is a very small piece of metal, which, according to family lore, is the only piece that came off the USS Monitor in the battle with the Merrimack.
You're kidding me. So an ironclad ship. So this is maybe a 4x6-inch frame with glass. Inside is a representation of a ship, I guess, and then this piece of 1/4-inch metal. Can you imagine staying afloat with all that metal over the whole ship? It's incredible. How do you know this is real?
I personally can't vouch for it being real, but I was not there.
Okay.
My great uncle Isaac Newton was the chief engineer on the Monitor, and he is the one who brought it home, apparently.
Amazing. Well, who would want to look at this?
Well, I would like to comment on it just for a second, because there are a lot of parts of the Monitor that were rolled here in Troy at the Rensselaer Ironworks, now in South Troy. Which became Portec, they remember, in the 1960s and early 70s. And there are a couple of other pieces that were done, pieces of the turret. The thing that's famous, of course, about the Monitor, the famous Battle of the Monitor and the Merrimack, it was changed naval warfare. Basically, the battle came to a draw. Both sides limped away. But nobody went to wooden boats after that. It really did change. And that's probably the most important thing in this revolving turret. Of what a lot of that was made here, and parts over in Albany and Schenectady as well. So Capital Region is very, that's a great piece.
And if my understanding is right, the forges in Troy used power from the streams from Rensselaer County, and I live on one of those streams, and I think that's very cool.
Wow.
After all these years, to come back to the place where part of the metal was made.
So you're on the Winant scale.
Yep.
Yes, the Henry Burden, the Burden Ironworks, and then all down the Red Sea. Yes, they harness that power.
Lauren Anderson, what do you think?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, thank you for bringing this in. It's a very special piece. There's a great tradition in shipwrecks where they salvaged pieces and made them into like little pieces of decorative arts mementos that you can find from almost every shipwreck that's out here that wasn't completely lost. It's kind of a collecting field, and it is something that people who love maritime art and decorative arts sort of gravitate to. So sometimes you find toothpick holders or things that are pipe stands or different types of objects that are fashioned from shipwrecks. So this is very unusual because I believe the Monitor was the first American ironclad ship. And one of the most wonderful things I think you have done to preserve the heritage of your object is on the reverse, you have noted all of the family lore and the provenance that you have received. So you can begin sort of to trace your journey back, plus your family heritage with your illustrious Isaac Newton relative, which I think is just fantastic for the story, to sort of, you know, amplify and create an example of what a neat little piece of history it is. Generally, shipwrecks... it depends on what ship they're from and how rare they are. So it's really hard to put a value on this, but I say it would probably be upwards of $1,000.
Wow.
And you know, Ray, you talked about things that come into the collection.
Yeah.
This is the great story. You know, it's something that was part of it. It's produced in Rensselaer County. They lived in Rensselaer County. It's still here in Rensselaer County. And we have a few other things, like just like you said, pieces like that that have mementos of either battlefields or ships. That's a great piece.
Well, yeah. Maybe if my kids don't fight over it, I'll contribute it.
We would love it. We would love
no
it.
Promises.
Tell you right
no
now,
promises.
We would love it.
I'm sorry, no negotiations during the show. But thank you very much. Appreciate it. That's a beautiful piece. We'll take a break now. We'll be back with more of the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Roadshow. Welcome back to the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Road Show. We are at the Hart Clewitt Museum in Troy, New York, in front of a live audience. All right, Mr. Hughes, what do we got?
Oh, I want to see Matt Churchio.
Hi, Matt. Oh.
Yes, well.
All
I
right,
think I'm
Matt.
Need your
where,
help with this, huh?
Where are you from?
We live in Gilderland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this looks
away.
Like what? A skeletal Uncle Sam? What is that?
It's a Uncle Sam doorstop.
Oh, cool. So this is about 8 inches high, 10 inches high.
Yeah.
Looks like it's lead, I would assume, and it's heavy.
Cast iron.
Oh, cast iron. And it is a piece of work. And so that depicts Uncle Sam?
Yeah. When my mom got tickets to the show and I heard it was in Troy, I was like, well, this probably would fit well. And. And I figured
it
I'd
sure
bring
does.
It by.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. I got it at auction a while back when I was getting into antiques. And actually, a local auctioneer, he'd always kind of like wink at me if he thought it was like a good piece. And that's how I acquired it many years ago, probably 10, 12 years ago.
Interesting. So, Kathy Sheehan, have you seen anything like this in your museum?
Yeah, we have a whole exhibit of this stuff downstairs.
Oh, interesting.
Do you have one of these?
We do. We have several drawer stops. What I think is interesting about that piece is that it shows that little bit of an earlier, it's that kind of Uncle Sam caricature by Thomas Nast, more so than James Montgomery Flagg, of course, does the Uncle Sam Wants You poster for World War I. So I think it's an earlier. You'd be able to date it more than I would.
But they didn't really start making these en masse until about 1860, 1870.
Yeah.
And then right up through 1940. I have five of these in my house. I have a Penguin Farm one. I have the Boston Pug. I have a shell casing one. So we love all these things. And they were practical because you had your windows open and you didn't want the doors to all get blown shut, right? So they have a really great use. This one is absolutely fantastic.
You can still see the paint on the pants.
They did make these in Albany, I found out. I did a little bit of research in a foundry there. So that's kind of cool. There's no stamps on it or anything. The most important part is I think it has its original paint.
Yeah.
Or
some of it that's left, which really makes a huge difference when we're looking at things. And it gets into the field of what we refer to as Americana, things that relate to American history, just like the piece from the monitor. Same as well, which just stirs ourselves about history.
On the bottom, the base of it, there is still some remnants of what used to read "for the open door," and I
so
thought
maybe
that
was somebody's. Sort
I
of
thought that was ironic because I think it tied into
I couldn't quite make
the
that
open
out.
Door policy in 1880 or 99, I believe.
Okay, well, that makes sense time wise then.
It's a door stop, so I think it was a bit of a play on
clever.
Words.
Yeah. Well, this was really nice, Matt.
This
thank
is
you.
A great thing. Do you remember what you paid for it, Matt?
Yeah, I paid $300.
Yeah, so I think you'd do pretty well if you were going to sell it again. I found records of them selling anywhere, one in 2010 at an auction by Bertoia, who's a great toy auctioneer and sells this sort of stuff, for $6,000.
Wow.
A little bit more paint, a little bit punchier, and they regularly trade between $1,000 and
$1,500. Nice. So not bad at all.
Wonderful, wonderful thing.
Thanks.
Matt,
I appreciate
thanks for doing
it.
The show.
Yeah.
Appreciate you being here.
Very exciting thing.
Thank you.
Hold it up whenever you're walking down.
Mr. Peter Hughes, we have someone else interested in coming up.
Yes, yeah, Susan Cortitz, come on down. Susan?
Susan passed out.
Susan with a chair, with a little chair.
Hello, Susan. Susan couldn't take the excitement. Yes. Oh, there she is. Splendid. Susan, that is lovely.
Hi, Susan. You can put that right there.
Susan, where are you from?
I'm from Albany.
And you brought a little teeny chair made out of wood. I would break this chair.
Yes, you would.
Yeah. So what's the deal?
This was a chair that my grandfather gave to me when I was a small child. And the family lore was that it was, he got it in Maryland when he lived there and supposedly was made by slaves.
Interesting. Let's put this over here in front of Colin.
So it's just been hanging out with me for the past 80 years.
When's the last time you sat in it?
Long time ago.
Really?
Long time.
Anybody want to have a go? No? It's a small chair, Colin.
It is a wee chair, isn't it, though?
So what do you think, man?
Well, it's a form of a chair we call the Windsor chair, which they started making these in England, and it's debatable whether it's about 1730 or 1750. And the reason they're called the Windsor chair is one day George III, King of England then, in about 1770, was wandering through Windsor Park, and he saw a man taking trees and taking green wood and bending it and putting it in seats. And he said, I'll have 12 of those for my house. So this is a child's Windsor chair.
Okay.
So the origins of it are 18th century. So they started making them in the 18th century, 1700s, and they never stopped. There's still people that make them today. There's individual craftsmen. There's companies that do them. They are a fascinating thing. I have a book this thick just on American ones. I've studied the vernacular difference between English Windsor chairs and the regionality. We've sold Windsor chairs for as much as $30,000.
Wow.
We just sold two of the finest examples I've ever seen last year. This one is sort of a little bit naive. It's made in America, you know, probably in that area. It doesn't have a lot of regional characteristics, but all of this wood is literally, they would make these, they'd set up a little sort of factory in the woods, and they'd take bits of hickory and different types of wood that they could bend, yew, elm, and the seats were usually of harder wood we talked about today, oak, ash, something like that. A lot of them also then got converted to little potty chairs.
Oh, no way.
Would cut a hole in them. So there's people just study their whole life Windsor chairs. But I think this one was probably made at the very end of the 1800s. And so somewhere between 1880 and 1920, based on its wear, its age, its patina. All of these things are sort of forced together and held together. And they have they split the top of this leg. It has this little stave. And they bang it in there, and it spreads the leg apart, and it keeps it together. So it was basically made with, like, very little glue and absolutely no metal hardware, which is kind of a cool thing. So unfortunately, somebody's come along a little bit later, which is typical, and replaced and stuck some screws in there doing little repairs. It's okay. Not the end of the world. There's nothing to suggest to me that this is slave-made at all, that there's could have just been, but they were made on farms, they were made by people, they're done as small, like, cottage industries, and they probably did them to sell to people as sort of almost like a novelty gift. So again, we're 1880, 1900, 1910. Lovely old thing, and at value in an antique store, somebody would ask probably around $350 for this. I don't think you're going to sell it anytime soon, nor should you. Is absolutely the charming thing. It's like like Uncle Sam. It's got nice old original paint. It's like charm personified.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I really appreciate
things.
It.
Well, thank you for being here on the show, Susan. Appreciate it. All right, Peter Hughes.
All right. Doug Williams, come on up.
All right, Doug. That's a big bot. What the?
Table,
what? Oh, neato. Okay. Now we're getting somewhere.
Why don't we stand it up and
turn it
the
other way? Yeah.
What do you think?
You need a hand? This is so cool. This is a game, right?
It's a pinball machine.
It is an ancient pinball machine, and this says, what does it say, Fleet on it? I only looked at it briefly. Huh?
I believe it's Bally.
I only saw it for a second. Now I can see the back of it, and the back is also exquisite. Where are you from?
I'm from right here in Troy.
Yeah, and so how did you come upon this?
I was doing some architectural salvage in an old house over on College Street. I wouldn't call it a basement, but it was underneath the house.
Ah, so it was under the house. Now you can see some rot there on the wood,
yeah,
so it probably
indeed,
sat
indeed,
there.
Indeed.
So which of you stair experts would be the one to go to
for
this?
Well, it's really none of us, but I made a little telephone call and inquired to some people who know about this sort of thing. And it is a really lovely thing. So imagine this. You're in a bar, it's 1937, you're having a great time, and this is how you're playing pinball on top of the, but didn't have legs, it was a tabletop pinball machine. We put our coin in here.
Are the flippers still there?
I don't think we had flippers.
Well, what do you do? Throw it around?
I think it's where the ball goes based on where it's tilting. So, you know, and after a few Rheingolds, you know, it didn't really matter anymore.
Ah, Rheingolds. Now we're getting somewhere.
Cue the beer tray.
Okay,
there we are. It's just, it's a lovely, lovely piece of Americana.
It really
they
is.
They refer to them as the Bally Fleet Junior model. And I think you'd said it also was made about 1934.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I can see concurs with that. This is where we get into condition, though. Missing parts of the front here, missing some pieces. But
I do have some pieces at home.
Nice old surface, nice paint. This has not been muckied around with in the front. So that's all very, very nice. I think it's also, it's kind of cool machine age looking.
Yeah.
It's almost like rocket age looking there, right? Which is, that didn't really happen until the 50s. So I think this was ahead of its time. It was made by the Bally Pinball Machine Company in Chicago, right? And it was this model that they sold to bars. And I think, what a great idea.
So what's it worth?
You know, this is one of those, it's like the guitar. They range all over the place. So then you can do some research and you can look up some auction records and see what they sold for. I saw them selling for anywhere between $1,100 and $6,500. Mm. Now the $6,500 one was like the holy grail. Now it had been packed up in like 1959. It was perfect. It was in an auction. That when you're selling these sort of things, though, getting them into the right types of sales, we wouldn't sell something like this. We'd call our friends at Morphy's. In central Pennsylvania that has machine, you know, antique machinery sales and stuff. So if you're ever contemplating selling it, finding the right place to do it. But it's a really cool thing.
Thank you.
Really,
and
really
Doug,
great.
You said you found this in a crawl space under a house.
Yes.
And we should also say this is, 3 feet long, 20 inches wide.
It's a tabletop pinball.
It's a tabletop pinball machine.
Do you have any pinballs with it?
I didn't have any of the pinballs.
No? Now, Doug mentioned that he had some parts that had broken off.
Sure.
Is restoration the right way to go with this, or do you leave it as is?
I think you've got to get a good, solid valuation from somebody who trades in these every day. If you're going to keep it, I might just put it on a little stand and leave it the way it is. I like old surface, you know, a little more survival survivor look. But, you know, some people like this stuff neatly restored. I will say the great thing is the way you've carried this in here. You put all these straps and then this harness, and you've been walking around with this large object that weighs 60 or 70 pounds for 3 or 4 hours. It's pretty remarkable, man.
Well, Doug, this is a great piece. Thank you for being on the show today. Fantastic.
Thank you, Doug.
You're going to keep it or you're going to sell it?
I think it belongs in the hands of a collector who can really appreciate it.
There you go.
Good.
Well, thank you. That's really cool. All right, Peter Hughes, who's next?
Ann Harrison, come on up.
Come on down.
Come on down.
Do we see Ann? Ann's way in the back.
This is the Ann section.
Oh, yeah, the three Ann's came in together. I saw them outside. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh, the Ann's, yes.
Ah, another one of the Ann's. Here, come on, sit down. Oh, look at that. Okay. Ann, where are you from?
Schoharie.
Schoharie, you came all the way from there today?
All the way from, yep.
Schoharie's beautiful.
Yes, it is. Gosh, it's lovely. Farm stands and beautiful locations. It really is nice.
So you brought a piece of porcelain, it looks like, right? And it's maybe 8 inches by 6 inches.
Right.
And it's green and yellow, and it looks like it has a bird that is in some sort of distress in the middle of it. What is that?
Well, it's a, what I know of it, it's a McCoy vase, and so that you can put flowers in it. If you look in here, it's got little places where you can put water and then put, put flowers or leaves or whatever, or leave it. And I'm trying to remember where I got it. I think I just probably picked it up in an antique place, and I like to collect vases. I have gardens, and so we...
it has McCoy on the bottom, USA.
Yep.
All right, Lauren Anderson, what do you think?
Well, that certainly is the real McCoy, as it is marked.
Look at the time.
I couldn't resist.
All right, cool.
Anyhow, McCoy is a pottery factory that started in Roseville, Ohio. And it started about 1910, and I think they were creating all the way up until the 90s. So
quite a long run for a factory of that nature. And it's one of the most collected types of pottery out here on the market, which is really wonderful. And a lot of their products have lovely glazes and bright colors, which this also has. A lot of forms inspired by nature, hence the birds. This one is really unusual, however, because of its square shape. And so it becomes more of a sculpture in addition to just being a vase. So it's just as pretty with flowers as without. And you were wonderful enough, Anne, to show us a photo of, I think it was a mantelpiece or a little cupboard?
Yeah, a cupboard, and yeah. That I've got a whole bunch of vases in that has two other bird sculptured, you know, vases also.
Exactly. So you have two of these vases that are similar, flanking in green, but this is yellow, so it's really the start of the show here. And, you know, again, it's just a wonderful part of American tradition. Reminds me of the prairie a lot when you begin to look at it, because of that color scheme and the birds that are just nested in the center. Because they're wildly collected, they're not as valuable as some other types of pottery, but you could easily find one at auction for around $75 and $100.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate
Anne,
it.
Anne, thank yes. you. And thank you all the other Anns. I appreciate it. Thank you for coming. All right. This is the last one, Peter. Oh, my heavens. Who do we have?
It's another Anne. Anne Ellery.
Ah, it's the Anne Show. Come
and
on.
And your oil
up.
Painting. I know you had another object, the oil painting.
Anne, is that with an E at the end or no E? No? Ah, you see. You got to watch out for that. Are you also from Schoharie, Anne?
No, I live in Troy.
You
from
live
Delmar.
In Troy. Well, this is very nice. This is a painting. It's a large, what is this, oil?
It's an oil on canvas from 1955, and Anne can tell us where it came from. It has a lovely provenance.
Okay. Well, my mother was an amateur artist. This is a painting by her teacher, Rudy Helmo, who is from the area, Pittstown. Mm-hmm. He's from Bavaria. I read about him this morning myself. But he worked and lived in Pittstown for a long time. This has been on our living room wall all the time growing up. And then I inherited it after my mom passed in Delmar.
I love this painting. I love the palette, the color scheme here. It's sort of ochre, yellow, fall colors with orange and green and blue. And it's a landscape painting with several farm buildings and could easily be a landscape anywhere around here. And I'm sure it was. Helmo was a local artist, as you said, and a member of the Albany Artists Guild, where he taught. And I guess your mother must have taken classes there.
And I read that he taught in a lot of different areas around the three counties.
He seems to have been a beloved teacher and obviously had a lot of talent, but talent as a teacher as well. This is really typical mid-1950s American painting. It's not abstract, but it's what we would call American modernism. And it's a style that was really prevalent in the late 40s through the early 60s in the United States. And from what I've seen of his work, this is really his style. It's a very flattened perspective with very little horizon line. So that's what makes it sort of modern with a capital M. And it seems that was his preferred composition. I think the paint is really well handled. It has a lot of quality to it. So you could tell that he was really talented as a teacher, but also in his own art practice. It's very typical. So many artists out there are really talented, but just do not have an established secondary market at auction where we see their paintings coming through the auction market. And it's just, there's no rhyme or reason to it, but it's very typical. His work has not sold at auction that I could find on a database. That doesn't mean it hasn't sold locally somewhere smaller that's just not captured by those databases. But he has been sold in galleries. He had gallery representation. And I did see, actually on First Dibs online, a painting of his similar composition and similar size sold for $750. So I think that's probably the price range you're looking at, but given the provenance and the fact that he was your mother's teacher, and it's such a beautiful painting, I hope it stays with
it's
you.
It's staying.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
We actually have a couple of Helmo paintings in our collection.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And Rudy actually taught right up this well. He probably taught at that time down in Washington Park, because he taught at the Art Center, which is now the Art Center of the Capital Region. At that time, it was Rensselaer County Council on the Arts. And so we have a number of people that knew Rudy, and he particularly did that Pittstown and Hoosick area, County 105, County 109. You could actually, you look at some of his painting, go, oh, I know that road. You know, you actually can tell through the hillside. So his
That's wonderful.
It's very unique, his work. Yeah,
very cool.
It's a great painting.
Well, it's great to learn more about him. And yes, we love this painting. So thank you.
Thank you for being here. Ah, fantastic. Beautiful. All right, that does it for the show, the Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Road Show. Hope you had as much fun as we did. Pretty, not bad, right? It was okay? Everybody? Yeah? All right. You know, 60% success. Thank you, live audience. You've been fantastic. Thanks to everybody who brought a treasure to share with us today. Thanks to Kathy Sheehan, the great one at the Hart Clewitt Museum here in Troy. Thanks to Colin Stair, Lisa Thomas, and Lauren Anderson from Stair. And we'll talk to you all on the radio soon. Thanks to our boss lady, CEO Sarah Gilbert, photographer Kayla Sacco, our producer, Peter Hughes, our live sound engineer, Nathan Scheid. Big thanks to Empire Audio. The Vox Pop Antique Appraisal on the Road Show was a production of WAMC on the Road. We have great things planned. Hopefully they don't involve me, but we have great stuff planned. Go to WAMC.org and find out more. For WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Vox Pop, I'm Ray Graff. Have a great rest of your day.